I'm Jeannie Allen, and this is Reality Check. Reality Check is produced by National Review and is one of more than a dozen podcasts offered on the National Review online website. If you'd like a free subscription to the podcast so that you never miss a program, simply sign up at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. My guest is a New Yorker on a mission to help parents everywhere get the opportunity they deserve to educate their children as they see fit. Thomas W. Carroll, or Tom, is the president of the Invest in Education Foundation and the Invest in Education Coalition, which are focused on the adoption of legislation to expand educational options for parents and children. He's the executive director of the EdTechs 50 Coalition, which has played a leading role in the recent expansion of 529 college savings accounts to include elementary and secondary school tuition. Tom Carroll also helped create the New York State Charter School Law, and founded a network of high-performing urban charter schools. He's held a number of positions in New York State Governor's Office, the state legislature, and is just all around a good guy and an old friend. Tom, welcome to Reality Check.
Thank you.
So I mentioned in your introduction this really all-important, encompassing event that happened recently through the tax reform legislation in Washington, D.C. So for our listeners out there who weren't following the close details beyond the fact that a bunch of people might get a tax cut or the controversy that ensued around it, tell us a little bit about what happened and what 529 is and why people out there should want to know about this.
Sure. I think people are even confused about the overall tax bill because it was done just before, in the midst of the holidays in December, and people were focused on other things. It was the first major overhaul of the tax code in 30 years. Hidden within that, it wasn't hidden, but a small provision that could have a dramatic impact was a provision that took the existing 529 college savings accounts, as you indicated, and now for the first time will allow people to withdraw money from those accounts and use it for K-12 or elementary and secondary tuition. These accounts are not funded by the government. They're funded by the parents themselves, relatives, other people who want to help them build up a nest egg for their child to go to college. So some people, given how the stock market has been going, have pretty substantial amounts of money in the accounts. There are 13 million accounts across the country, $300 billion, that's right, billion in assets. Mm-hmm. So it's a program that's grown pretty quickly. So now you're taking that footprint and allowing it to go down all the way down to elementary and secondary education. So from a parent perspective, as soon as you know you're having a child or your child is born, you can establish one of these accounts. And rather than thinking of it exclusively as something that's for college, which is long, long away, you can think of it more as this is the money I'm setting aside for education for my child. And starting from the very beginning of their education to the end of the college, you now have a way to save your own money, but to do it without Uncle Sam taking a chunk of it out for taxes. So anyone who knows how compound interest works knows the longer you keep it in there, the more money you have. Mm-hmm. The longer you keep it in there without Uncle Sam taking a slice each year, the more money you'll end up for your children in the end. So I think it's a very positive thing.
So if I have a college account today, I can start using it for K-12 immediately, or is that something that's still going to be phased in?
Yeah, a lot of people are confused because most of the provisions apply in 2018, and that's for taxes that you're filing the tax form in April of 2019. This provision took effect January 1st of 2018, so the money can be withdrawn right away. You have to figure out, depending what state you live on, whether there's other state tax considerations. But from a federal tax perspective, you can start making the withdrawals right away. Now, from a school choice perspective, a number of people have been trying to get school choice adopted by Congress and the series of presidents in the last 20-some-odd years, and they've always come up short. The highest number of votes they got were like 46 or 48 in the U.S. Senate. This also is politically significant because it's the first time that a national school choice measure has been adopted in the past 20 years.
But let me interrupt you for a second, because even though school choice has been around for over 30 years, and actually lots of, you know, economists have been talking about this idea prior to that, it's not necessarily well defined. So let's just go back and talk about what we're talking about. And we've been in a forum together recently where we're trying to educate Capitol Hill staffers, the media, people who work in and around education. it's about money, right? So really, at the end of the day, we're talking about how you spend money.
Well, it's about money and freedom.
Okay. And freedom to do what? Within what? Like, what's wrong with traditional public schools for my kids?
So the broad concept is that it's freedom for a parent to choose what is the best educational opportunity for their child. Personally, I'm an all-of-the-above school choice person. I want there to be lots and lots of options. It's the reason Baskin and Robbins has so many flavors, because not everybody likes the same flavor ice cream. So I don't have a stake in whether somebody goes to a public school, private school, religious school, public charter school, or they homeschool their children. I don't know their children. That's for them to decide. They know the best. And both of us have, you know, multiple children. And you know, within your own family, children have different personalities. They have different learning styles. They have different academic interests. And parents have different interests in terms of how big is faith in their life and do they want that to be the life for their children. And so, and there's certain just kind of values that some people are not, you know, would prefer a religious setting. Some people don't want that at all. So I'm not saying you have to do it my way or the highway. I'm just saying I want lots of options and I want the parents to sort it out. When it comes to the money, I often steal a phrase that you popularized, which is that I'm in favor of a backpack plan. You take all the money that is now allocated by public schools or by taxpayers for each child, put it in a backpack, and depending where you are in New York, that could be $20,000 a year. Mm-hmm. In other places, it's, you know, it probably would be a lot less. And whoever can educate that kid to the satisfaction of the parent gets to empty out the backpack and keep the money.
Right.
To me, if you did that, the number of people running around making sure that they could get access to the money would motivate people. And I'm not saying education's all about money, but we now have a structure in education where it's all about systems and not about children.
That's right. And the money goes to those systems. And it's fascinating to me. You know, a couple of things you're talking about, you know, looking at how we can help parents make decisions that best fit their kids. I also had a guest on Reality Check, that Elric Christensen, who's a brain scientist. In fact, he just got a huge infusion of cash to further advance this notion of adaptive learning so that school programs, approaches to learning, he does it a lot in higher education, but sees the relevance to K-12, that wherever you are sitting today in a classroom, if you're a student, or if you're an adult going back to school, how you learn and how you engage and the pace at which you learn is going to vary, not because you're unequal, smarter or less, but because your capacity is different depending on the material. And it turns out one of the things that brain scientists argue today is your synapses are different, right? And how do you fuse those back together? And so it actually turns out that your environment for learning, what you're required to learn, is very different from place to place. And that's not something that school choice advocates have tended to talk about. We've been about the economics, the freedom, the parental rights. Isn't it more than that?
Well, I think what you're talking about, kind of the evolving knowledge we have about science and learning, is very important. But it all comes down to the same issue. There are a lot of factors that go into an educational decision. But the foundational question is, whose child is it? And who gets to make the decision, factoring in all of these things? For somebody who's in a really bad neighborhood, they may not be focused on the scientific research. They may be focused on being comfortable that when their child is dropped off at school in the morning, that they're going to get home safely at night. So if you're in a safer suburban neighborhood, you might not worry mm-hmm. about safety concerns. But for some people, that's paramount. Other people want to, for argument's sake, a Montessori education. Some people have looked at the growing research around differences in gender development, which affects how children learn and how they learn different subjects at different ages.
Right.
Some people care about that and value it mm-hmm. and can act on it. Other people don't care about it and prefer to have, you know, boys and girls all together. There are a lot of different opinions. There's also education is essentially a value proposition, and I don't mean financially. It reflects the value, what you how value as a parent. Do you want a back-to-basics education? Do you care more about arts? Do you care about creativity? You want to make sure your kid has strong presentation skills. There's a lot of different things that go into the discretionary design of a school. And so I want there to be lots of schools, and I want people to have lots of ability to choose those schools. And then all education doesn't occur within a school. And that's why at a recent event we were at together, one of the things we talked about was education savings account.
Right.
Sometimes it might be people like homeschoolers banding together to hire an expert or go on field trips.
To create their own programs.
Create their own program. It might be an after-school activity. It might be tutoring.
It might be that your child is in high school, but they could actually access college courses, and you really want them to have that additional enrichment.
Sure. The dual enrollment in high school and particularly community colleges is very important to a lot of parents. So there's a lot of factors that
tutoring.
Go into all of this.
We all know that our kids have gone through schools. We haven't done it ourselves. The other people have. You're constantly looking for ways. I mean, parents do, at the end of the day, want what's best. And part of this really is providing for more opportunity for people who don't necessarily have those things naturally, that don't pursue those things naturally. Let's talk about your big blue state of New York. You know, one of the reasons I'm hearing you talk about the diversity in the values of what you want in education and the kinds of things you want to tailor to your kids, you had a huge role to play in helping craft the state's charter school law back in the 90s. There were some really fun political stories we've shared about that. Governor Pataki signed it into law. There was a little bit of horse trading to get it in. And then you started charter schools. What did you see that really, like, was it a surprise to you in a way what happened? And talk a little bit about those initial schools opening and the response of parents.
Sure. So there was, as in many states, when either a scholarship program is established or new charter schools are established, there's a tremendous pent-up demand of parents that felt trapped in their limited one-size-fits-all option. And so when these options are suddenly put upon or put in front of them, first, there's a shock. There's kind of they're not sure what to do about it. But once they realize that they actually they almost think like it's a trick or something. But once they realize they actually do get to make the decision and it's nobody else has control over that decision, it's very empowering. So there's almost a liberal paternalistic attitude, particularly in urban areas where they're not sure, kind of the people with advanced degrees, that these parents actually have the wherewithal to make the correct decisions for their children. The attitude of the parents is completely different, is they've watched these so-called education experts deliver an education to their children that is not safe and is not high quality. And they also notice that a lot of the people that assign their kids to a neighborhood school never would send their own children to their school. So, for example, in contrast, one of the most successful charter networks in New York is run by Eva Moskowitz, Success Academy. She actually sent her own children to those schools. They had to get through the lottery like everybody else, but they were able to get through the lottery. And so they were going to an urban school in Harlem. And that's not what people were surprised that she did that, but she believed that the quality of education she was providing was suitable. And she wouldn't imagine providing a substandard quality of education that wasn't good enough for her kids, but was good enough for somebody else's children. Wink, wink.
Right.
And that's essentially how the entire New York City public school system is set up. And so you have lots of people have a right of exit, and they get themselves into certain schools that everybody knows are the better schools, or they have enough money. Like, for example, Michael Mulgrew, who's head of the New York City Teachers Union. Well, what did his parents do when they didn't like the local public schools? They sent the head of the New York City Teachers Union when he was a little child to New York City Catholic schools. Mm-hmm. So he and his brother went to Catholic schools in Staten Island. I don't begrudge them making that choice. I'm a little surprised that he's not also in favor of extending that choice to other people. But lo and behold, there are thousands of his members of the United Federation of Teachers that send their kids to Catholic schools.
And isn't that still the case? There was a study we helped do years ago. Heritage has repeated it. Where do public school teachers send their kids? And in urban areas, I mean, the numbers, I remember the percentages were over 50% in some cases, Boston, New York, Chicago, even D.C. You know, so you just raised the union. And we're talking about what happens when you do establish these kinds of choices. And we know that there's kicking and screaming. And one of my big frustrations, Tom, is that while Democrats like Eva Moskowitz love this and she's fought tooth and nail to get these schools, to maintain them, she fights politically. Certainly Republicans also in many cases fight politically. But when it comes to state legislatures and the Hill, both parties, like a pox on their houses, we can't seem to move this very quickly. Kentucky passes a weak charter school law. to get any kind of hearing or passage of all Republicans plus Democrats on Capitol Hill for portability for kids or ESAs is a tremendous lift. Why? This is such common sense. We're talking about parents. We're talking about kids.
It depends on what part of the country you're talking about. In states with large urban centers, it's really simple. It's just the naked brute power of the teachers' union. In other areas, if you're talking down south in right-to-work states, it's not the teachers' union. It's more often the school superintendent or the football coach, because the school systems, like hospitals or healthcare industry, are generally the largest employers in a lot of congressional districts and a lot of local communities. And so if they're not looking for competition, often even without the help of the teachers' unions, they'll knock it off. You're seeing this is playing out in Texas, for example. But one of the ironies of Texas is one of the strongest supporters of school choice is Senator Ted Cruz, who got through the 529 reform.
Mm-hmm.
But the Texas state legislature is bottled up doing a scholarship tax credit there for kindergarten through 12th grade.
And so is the key to make this issue as political as the issues that pass? And if so, how? How do you – we know that both parties – frankly, it's tripartisan, as our pollster, Kellyanne Conway, once said years ago when she was just a pollster. It's tripartisan. Demographically, it's broad. But we have the power. We have the unions. It means somebody needs to have a fire in the belly, right? You had a Democratic state legislature in part with Pataki in chartering a lot of the charter laws around the country. A lot of the school choice programs and vouchers and scholarships are bipartisan. But yet again, it's an uphill battle. Is it money? Do people have to put more money into politics? You know, a lot of conservatives don't like to put money into politics when it comes to education. What's the answer?
Yeah, well, just in terms of word choice matters, I don't think it's a question of liberal or conservative. I think it's there's no doubt that the teachers union is more at the state level. The teachers union gives money to both sides. And then so you could have problems with both sides if you're trying to do something the teachers unions don't like. At the national level, 95-98% of the teacher union money goes to the Democratic Party. That's just a strategic decision the teachers unions have made.
Mm-hmm.
So when Democrats in, that's great for them. When the Republicans control everything, like right now, not so great. So you saw in the 529 bill what happened is every single Democrat, well, on the tax bill and on the 529 issue, voted against it. And every two exceptions I'll get to, every single Republican voted for it.
Mm-hmm.
So elections have consequences mm-hmm. because in this case, I'm making an observation. I'm not shilling for one part or the other.
Right.
I don't belong to either of the major parties. But it is the reality that most Republicans are in favor of school choice. Most Republicans are not beholden to the teachers union. You have a president, no matter what you think of him, he is certainly not in the thrall of Randy Weingarten. I don't think he gives a moment's thought to what Randy Weingarten or the NEA thinks on educational issues.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a unique moment in time that way. That hasn't been true of any president that I can recall in recent memory. So that's kind of where we are right now. I think overall, and when I'm operating in a blue state, we've attempted to raise political money to offset the teachers' unions. We've spent a lot of time building out a very diverse coalition. And that coalition includes a lot of people that would not be called conservative or Republican, that's for sure. And we were able, around the tax credit, education tax credit issue, to get a majority of Democrats and Republicans to be in favor of it. That wasn't the case when the charter school law was adopted. Had a lot of private school choice people who mm-hmm. were concerned when charters got adopted in New York. And my argument was, to go back to ice cream, is when you give people strawberry and chocolate instead of everybody have to eat vanilla, it doesn't mean they're totally satisfied. Once they realize they can have other flavors of ice cream, they're going to want all kinds of flavors of ice cream. And that's what happened. Politically, it showed legislators, including Democrats, you could do something. Nobody ended up getting thrown out of office because they voted for the charter school law. And then suddenly, the teachers' unions lost 7 or 8 votes in a row in a legislature, which when you have a Democratic governor and a Democratic state assembly, they were still losing
right.
votes because people realized they almost had freedom of thought, which is kind of a novel notion for state legislators sometimes. So, but it was because we spent a lot of time building the coalition, because they realized when they looked at their district, the people going to charter schools were their constituents,
right.
part one. Part two, most of the people going to charter schools are Democratic voters.
And it goes back to this whole notion of education of people, really. I mean, you and I have been in so many rooms over time. Lots of people listening have this experience in their own home, in their community. A lot of us don't know until we talk to someone else the struggle someone is having with schooling. You know, if you talk to parents who send their kids to schools of choice because of that program or because of great sacrifice, if you talk to the graduates of private school choice programs, charter schools, other kinds of alternatives, they are so engaged and excited, and they are evangelists about the fact that these schools save their lives. And that's not a dramatic analogy. They say these things, that it was life-changing. And so we know that that experience happens, but it's like almost a retail sale. You know, in other words, most of us grew up with the system that we have. And so we question whether or not an alternative is better or parents can make those choices. What we don't know is what we don't know. Right. And so how do you help people understand that this is not just about education? This is a national security issue.
Well, Nation at Risk back in 1983, I think it was, pointed out, you know, that if a foreign government had invaded and done this, you know, we would be alarmed and declare war. Mm-hmm. And we have one of the lowest skill levels of industrialized countries. So that's part one. And part two, we also have a skills gap in this country in which we have roughly, the numbers are not coincidentally similar. You have 6 million people unemployed. And at the same time, you have 6 million jobs that are going begging in this country. Now that they've passed the tax reductions, if you believe that that's going to create millions of more jobs, that's actually going to accentuate that.
Exactly.
So we're going to have more and more jobs, and we still haven't solved the skills gap problem. So there's a very strong need for, one, having a more nuanced view of education. Not everybody necessarily has to go to college. There are a lot of trades that people can go through an apprentice route that don't require a college education, that generation after generation, families have raised, you know, through a middle-class existence, have raised children and grandchildren and so forth. And so I think we have to recognize that. Military, obviously, is an option as well. But we have to incentivize people to get into those programs, to workforce training, to close the skills gap. And on the military side, if people go into the military, we want to have flexibility for those people, meaning the parents, they need to have quality educational options for their own children, which is very important. And on things like the 529 accounts, you think your kid's going to college, they might sign up to go to the military. You've built up a large nest egg for mm-hmm. them to go to college. They now have flexibility. You can switch that to another child within the family. And now if you have younger siblings that are in high school, when you've gone off to the military as the older brother or the older sister, you can instantly reallocate that money.
You know, I'd like to say that college might not be for everyone, but higher education is, because there's a whole different set of offerings out there. Maybe it's not the four-year residential college where you're away from your home most of the year for 4 years. Maybe it's actually you started there and you didn't complete it for whatever reason. Life got in the way. You were challenged. You weren't mature enough. But there's higher education that can continue to help you build what you know and your skills. And it might end up, if you have access to that higher education, that you complete some level of degree. Maybe it's technical, and maybe that's fine. But the reality is everyone should have that pathway. And you're right, Tom, we're not providing that pathway to these more sophisticated technological jobs that are out there today. We're not helping people finish what they started or allowing them to use what they started to go to some other kind of program, because the restrictions on those programs or how you spend federal and state money are onerous. So it's 2018. What do we do? What's our big proposal for Capitol Hill, for the administration, on how to tie K-12 workforce and apprenticeships?
I think the answer is to I'm very leery at the federal level of any program run through the U.S. Department of Education, because I've seen, particularly during the Obama administration, which they've used the stream of money as an excuse for the federal government to get extremely prescriptive as it relates to parents, as it relates to bathrooms, as it relates to schools. And I think it's a much cleaner way is to play around with tax incentives to encourage the outcome that you want.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in favor of doing a tax credit that provide scholarships to people to enroll in apprentice programs, workforce training. That's basically geared towards adults. And at the same time, we want to make sure that the skills gap doesn't get magnified with the next generation being miseducated, that we want to have scholarships encouraging people at the elementary and secondary level to go to schools that give them the highest quality education possible. So I think that that's an idea that could work. There are other, I'm an all of the above reformer. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's a single thing that solves all of the problems. I also think we have to do something on the military side.
Absolutely.
And I think we have to do something that's more respectful of people who pick ideas that some people view as outside of the mainstream, like homeschooling. So I have relatives who have homeschooled. I have tremendous respect for the sacrifice that they've made. But in terms of public policy in D.C., those people are treated like lepers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not right. And people don't appreciate the gift that these people are giving their children and they're giving the nation by making the sacrifice to educate their children at home.
You know, I've met a number of families who use various kinds of virtual schools and online learning. Many of them are doing so through a charter school, but the school is actually not brick and mortar. It's online or virtual. And a lot and very similar to homeschoolers. In fact, some of them were homeschoolers, but they couldn't afford the kind of program. But they are all shapes, sizes, attitudes. I've met the Broadway producer whose kid is on Broadway and they need a different kind of environment. I've met the woman who was a public school teacher whose daughter was bullied. You know, I've met the exceptional students, the paraplegic student. I mean, the notion that we think there's one size fits all still to this day in 2018 when we wouldn't accept that for anything else in life is still extraordinary. So it sounds hopeful. It sounds like we're moving in the right direction. What should people do?
I think people should reach out to their congressmen and even the White House and indicate that particularly in this year, because who knows what's going to happen in the midterm elections, that it's very important that this once-in-a-lifetime or once-in-a-generation opportunity to get something meaningful done on education reform does not pass us by.
I think that's absolutely critical. Tom Carroll, you have been a tremendous guest. Tom Carroll is with the Invest in Education Foundation, Ed Tax Credit 50 Coalition. If you go online to National Review Online or edreform.com, you can get lots of information about where to contact Tom, how to subscribe and listen to Reality Check, this episode and future ones. And thanks so much for listening. I'm Jeannie Allen. Reality Check is a weekly podcast produced by National Review and posted on Monday at nationalreview.com. If you like what you heard in this podcast, and I hope you did, you might want to subscribe for free and make sure you don't miss any future programs. You can subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And you can also find much more about education reform, opportunity, and innovation at the Center for Education Reform's website, edreform.com. Don't forget, tune in to Reality Check every week.